Welcome to Empire's Podcast, The Ottomans. I am Frank, your host. So, after hearing me talk about it for some time, it's finally here, the show's website. It's a bit rusty around the edges, but I promise I'll be improving it over time. The goal is for me to post daily under the blog portion, so here you can check out news, updates, and maybe just some really cool facts that never really made it onto the regular show. This will help sharpen my brain for when I begin the official newsletter of Empire's Podcast, The Ottomans. More on that later. I'd like to give a warm, heartfelt thank you to everyone who stuck with me so far. I plan on keeping with the podcast for as long as it takes us until we finally reach the end in 1923. In case you're wondering as well, Part 2 of Dracula will be released in the next week or so. So let's jump back into it. Sultan Mehmed II, The Forgotten Years of 1451 through 1453, Episode 24. In most history podcasts touching on Sultan Mehmed II's reign, you're treated to the bread and butter, the siege of Constantinople, his wars in the Balkans against Dracula, and then maybe some odds and ends about how he passed this or that law. In fact, just based on the shows, the specials, and the conversations around Mehmed, you'd think his reign only lasted for like 5 years or so. And during that time, at some point, he took the great city of Constantinople. When plotting out the next 5 or so episodes, which will cover the second reign of Mehmed, I've decided to put the focus on a lot of the background noise, the kind of stuff these other podcasts and YouTube channels have left out. Mehmed's second reign as Sultan would be one of the longest. It clocked in at around 30 years for his second reign, and even longer if we're going to count the time he first took a shot at the Sultanate. During his second reign as Sultan from 1451 through 1481, the Ottoman Empire would go through an absolute whirlwind of change. Again, as I said before, most of the shows out there, they're going to focus on the cool and exciting stuff, the fall of Constantinople, etc., etc. But I'm going to start us off with the ascension of Mehmed II, the reforms and changes he made starting on day one. Before we get to Constantinople, I think it's very important, and I know my listeners will agree with me, that we properly lay the groundwork and get into the context through which Mehmed would later make the decisions which he did. A great place for this is the often overlooked and very sore scant periods from his ascension in February of 1451 till around the time of March of 1453 before the invasion plans of Constantinople really got underway. We often think of the fall of Constantinople as the real beginning, if you will, of the Ottoman Empire as a powerhouse. But reforms, diplomacy, and the actions took by Mehmed from the time periods of 1451 through 53, well, they're equally as important and often overlooked. With that being said, guys, let's get the lay of the land on what challenges faced Mehmed when he took the throne for his second and final time, aged 19 years old. His first act as Sultan was to seize his little half-brother, who was barely a few months old, and he had the infant prince executed. He then issued an edict, retroactively legalizing the fratricide of not only his half-brother's murder, but also legalizing the murders of past Ottoman princes, put to death by whomever happened to be Sultan at the time. It was this decree that the future Ottoman sultans legalized a barbaric practice that whenever a new Ottoman sultan would take the throne, any and all close male relatives were to be executed. And this was a practice which would, unfortunately, persist for centuries. His next great hurdle was in dealing with the Janissaries and the Old Guard. And by Old Guard, I mean the families that hailed from Anatolia and had had a firm control over the centers of power ever since the mid-1300s. Emerging from the defeat of Bayezid, the lightning bolt, in 1403, and through the reign of Murad II, the empire had fought its way through internal civil wars, external threats like the Crusades, the political and diplomatic machinations of the Byzantines, plagues, and they desperately attempted to assert their legitimacy among the fellow Muslim powers. Holding the line and keeping the handbasket from tipping over into this hell were the old Turkish families, the ones the likes of which Pasha Kandarli hailed from, and if you recall from episodes 21 and 23, there's no love lost between Kandarli and Mehmed. These old families controlled the reins of power. They were the top administrators when it came to collecting tithes and taxes, which was used by the powers that be to pay the Ottoman state. These families staffed the generals, the top religious judges, and diplomats. They were, in the fullness of the term, the elites of the Ottoman Empire. They were also extremely conservative in terms of military innovations, tactics, and weapons. They were eternally mistrustful of their sometime ally and sometime enemy, the Janissaries. And up until the reign of Murad II, the Janissary Corps suffered at the hands of deliberate misappropriation of supplies, rations, logistics, and pay. Even the restorer of the empire, Mehmed I, he was unable to push back too hard against the old families. For them, the Janissaries and new military units of the empire, they represented a structural threat to their power. Although the Janissaries proved useful idiots to the old guard, after Kandarli, if we recall, he had little trouble in turning their wrath and fury against a young Mehmed in 1444. The old guard was well aware that if the Janissaries grew in numbers too fast, they could easily upset the apple cart. This meant that for Mehmed I and Murad II, the uneasy alliance between the Janissaries and the old guard families always represented a threat to the Sultan's authority. All of this would change, however, with Mehmed II. He was determined to break both the power of the Janissaries as well as the old guard. The Janissaries are really going to come into their own under Mehmed II. Past sultans, although placing high value on the core, they were extremely careful not to grow their numbers too fast. For one thing, they didn't want to piss off the old families. And two, it was really expensive. And three, why actively create an army that could turn on you and overthrow you? In March of 1451, Mehmed II marched with a loyal bodyguard, and I love this. They called themselves the Hound Keepers, or Sakban. This was a group of young men who numbered around 3,000. From out of the Christian levy system, the Dervishermi, Mehmed had carefully gathered these guys around himself during his exile, after he was forced to step down from the Sultanate the first time. In Anatolia, he drew these men, who had no local loyalties, and who were totally dependent upon Mehmed, and trained them to the latest Ottoman tactics and weapons with every intention one day of heading back to Edirne and settling the score with the Janissaries who had humiliated him. The same Janissaries who had yanked him out of his palace at the behest of Kandarli. Arriving in Edirne in late March of 1451, Mehmed had the ringleaders of the coup against him brought before him. The hounds rounded them up, and pretty soon he ordered their executed bodies thrown into the streets. The Aga of the Janissaries was spared, the Aga, if you recall, being the commandant of the corps. And also, he wasn't a product of the Christian slave levy system. Instead, he had hailed from a privileged family from Anatolia. And so he, along with his entire staff, were promptly fired. Mehmed then took all the remaining Janissaries, many of them at this point were veterans of Varna in Kosovo, and from their ranks selected the most well-respected rank-and-file soldiers, men spotlighted for their bravery, individuals who had proved loyal to the Sultan on the battlefield, and these were the same men who also hailed from the Christian levy system. These individuals, for all they knew, were probably going to be executed one late April night in 1451. They were roused from their barracks and marched an hour outside the city. Torches illuminated the grand tent erected around the tent of Mehmed. The grim houndkeeper guard stood about as the Janissaries were led inside. Instead of an expected execution, these Janissaries were treated to an excited Mehmed, who began presenting maps of Constantinople. It is said that during the night, he implored the Janissaries to remember their honor and oaths they took to the Sultan, and to always keep their eyes on the real prize, the great city itself. Hey there, I promise we will return to the show, and I wanted to offer three ways you can support the show. This is a passion project of mine, but everything comes at a cost in terms of time and money. From researching these battles and discovering intriguing historical characters along the way, like Mehmed II and John Hunyadi, and then bringing their stories to life, well, this all takes place after hours, so to speak. I work a full-time job, and bringing the story of the Ottomans to life happens after everyone is asleep. So far, there isn't another podcast out there providing you with a blow-by-blow, decade-by-decade narrative about the Ottomans like the one you're listening to. With that said, I hope you'd consider three ways to support me and our show. This doesn't involve money, only about 1 minute of your time. First, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, leaving me a 5-star review. These reviews are the street cred that helps me to attract new listeners. Second, if you are listening on Spotify, please scroll on up and leave me a 5-star review on the Spotify review tab. Believe me, people pay attention to what you think about the show. Third, and the best way you can help, please share this podcast with a friend. I'm sure there are someone out there who loves narrative history, and why not introduce them to the Ottomans? Thank you, and now let's return to the world of the Ottomans. By mid-1451, Mehmed had totally reorganized the Janissaries. He kicked out of their ranks some 4,000 soldiers whom he considered useless. Guys who had bought their way into an officer's commission, again, most of these people came from Anatolia, soldiers with severe disciplinary records, and general malcontents, or people Mehmed simply didn't like. He then restructured the entire Janissary corps from the ground up, and in doing so, he incorporated his houndkeeper units directly into the corps itself. For the rest of 1451, till the siege of Constantinople, Mehmed would test his elite Janissaries, purge their ranks evermore, enforce training and discipline, and above all, war game when his soldiers were in the field, or when they were out campaigning, having constant reviews. The result of all this training and effort was that when Mehmed finally passed away in 1481, the Janissaries had become the absolute best fighting formation in Europe and also the Middle East, more than what the world had ever seen up till that point, and they had really become the trump card for the Ottoman military. From the outset, Mehmed made sure that everyone around him, the old families he couldn't move against just yet, like Kandarli, his administrators, generals, and foreign diplomats, Mehmed told everybody his intention of taking Constantinople. It might not be today, might not be tomorrow, but the decade wasn't going to close without the city falling into Ottoman hands. To this end, during his exile in Anatolia after he stepped down for being Sultan the first time, not only was Mehmed plotting his eventual return to power, but by raising the houndkeepers, placing strategic bribes, and generally positioning himself for the coming day of his return, he also meticulously studied the past campaigns, the efforts of the Muslim powers to take on the city of Constantinople. When Mehmed decided to take a stab at the great city, he'd be the 13th Muslim ruler to attempt to do so. All others before him had failed. From his study of military history, Mehmed crafted a strategy for taking Constantinople, and this composed of three main points. First was diplomatic. A siege of the great city was bound to take weeks at the least. It was important for the Ottomans to make sure all their flanks were secured. This would require a punitive expedition into Anatolia to make sure the Turkish beys brought in under Murad II weren't going to sit around and get any smart ideas, most especially the Karmanids. This would also entail doing everything possible for the Ottomans to keep the Christian powers in the West away from their frontier while they could conduct a proper siege. Second, they needed a darn navy. The Ottomans, since the naval defeat just off Gallipoli in 1416, in which you can head on over and listen to that I covered in episode 17, the Ottomans were totally reliant upon the goodwill of the Byzantines, the Genoese, and the Venetians if they meant to ferry troops and supplies across the straits. During the Crusade of Varna and the Second Battle of Kosovo, the entire Ottoman military apparatus in the Balkans could have fallen completely apart if Murad and Mehmed had not been allowed to cross the straits by the Western powers. Only the divided nature of the Christian nations is what allowed the Ottomans to move troops around. However, a siege of Constantinople might, Mehmed calculated, just might, unite all of Christendom, and there was no guarantee the Ottomans could bribe their way across the strait this time. The third thing Mehmed calculated the Ottomans really needed was artillery. Now, although the Ottomans had made strides in artillery and the use of gunpowder, they were small in number, and the scale of the siege needed, if they were going to take Constantinople, meant not just volleys of fire from cannons, but they needed cannons that were larger than anything ever built. They also needed the logistical support system necessary to move, transport, maintain, and supply these monsters as well. After having reorganized and pacified the Janissaries by the close of 1451, Mehmed received reports that the provinces brought in by his father in Anatolia, those of Adin, Mentesi, and Germain, were raising an army, and they were seeking aid from the Karmanids. Not wasting any time, Mehmed marched out with an army straight from Edirne. Mehmed moved at once to implement his plan of securing his eastern flank. What better time for the eastern provinces to start acting stupid than now? The leader of the Karmanids, a man named Ibrahim, learned Mehmed was marching with an Ottoman army and was headed straight for the wayward provinces he had just encouraged to rise up in rebellion. When the massive size of Mehmed's punitive force reached Ibrahim, and that the Sultan had mustered some 90,000 men with more on the way, Ibrahim thought better of the scheme. The plan, originally, had been to send money to the provinces and stir up rebellion, and it was really meant as a way to test the young Sultan and see what he was made of. And they decided they wanted nothing to do with the Ottomans, and soon sued for peace, hopefully before Mehmed's army passed the old battleground of Ankara, the same fateful spot Bayezid himself had been defeated decades ago. Stopping now his march on the Carmenids, Mehmed turned his fury to the three erstwhile rebellious provinces. He allowed his troops to pillage and rape their way through these areas for roughly 2 weeks, when word reached the Sultan that the Emperor of Constantinople, Constantine the 11th, was requesting an increase in money for the upkeep of the only known surviving Ottoman male family member who was held as a hostage in Constantinople. Mehmed was furious and ordered his army to march north and across the Dardanelles, while, in the meantime, he would stop off in Gallipoli. It is a testimony to Mehmed's character that he didn't immediately march on the great city right there and then, but the clever Sultan was sticking to his plan. It was now time to head on down to the foundries and shipyards at Gallipoli, and Sultan Mehmed ordered a navy to be constructed. This project would take a little more than a year, but by the time Mehmed marched on Constantinople in April of 1453, he had roughly 100 medium-sized galleys, which managed to secure the straits and allow the freedom of his armies to travel, and also to cut off the great city from the rest of the world. Looks like part two of that equation has been solved. Next, in early 1452, Mehmed headed back up to Edirne, executed a few officials along the way, the excuse given that the roads had not been properly kept up, and settled in for the remaining winter to begin a flurry of diplomatic activity. His campaign into Anatolia the year previous had secured his eastern flank, at least for the near future. His shipyard in Gallipoli were working round the clock to build him ships as fast as they could be laid down. His budding navy's biggest hurdle being that they couldn't find enough experienced crews to man the vessels just constructed. And this would be a problem which would plague the Ottoman navy in the centuries to come. Now what was needed was to make every effort to sign peace treaties with the Christian nations which surrounded his empire. To this end, he renewed several treaties with Hungary, Serbia, Albania, and parts of Greece under Venetian and Genoese control. He even offered the regent of Hungary, the Ottomans' bitter enemy John Hunyadi, gold and other offerings to secure a 10-year peace deal, in much the same vein as had been signed before the Crusade of Varna. Next up was a general reform of the Ottoman military. Most especially was in organizing the Akinchi warriors into smaller units. Local commanders could more easily, if not control, then it made things accounting for a lot easier. He also suspended some redundant units, along with their heavy command structures, added yet more janissaries, and more importantly, expanded the cannon corps of the military. To this end, Mehmed reached out to one of the greatest cannon founders of his day, a guy named Orban. Orban was a Hungarian who had spent his youth learning about the arquebuse from Italian guilds, and he had played around with all sorts of gunpowdered pieces most of his life. We don't know much about him. Some say he was born in 1400, others say he was older. To be honest with you guys, I'm not quite sure. What we do know is that Orban went to the emperor in Constantinople and offered his services to the Byzantines. However, the emperor was unable to pay him the salary he had requested, not to mention the material he would need to construct his gigantic cannon. Leaving the Byzantine court in 1452, Orban headed down to go meet Sultan Mehmed II. He had heard about his plans to take the great city, as well as the young sultan's fascination with gigantic cannons, of which Orban took plans to one that he called Mons Meg, a true monstrosity, which we will talk about in the next episode. He showed up in the court of Edirne and presented his plans to the sultan in person, one wintry day in February of 1452. The Sultan was super impressed and is said to have paid Orban double his asking price, as well as provided slaves, soldiers, the best engineers and officers to build the cannons needed. By the middle of 1452, Sultan Mehmed had secured both his western and eastern flanks. His navy wouldn't be ready till the following year, yet the project was moving along. His reorganization of the Janissaries were paying off, as Mehmed observed their training in wargaming. The corps was now composed of men, almost exclusively recruited from the Derbshirmi system, the slave levy, and the hanger-ons and malcontents had been drummed out. What's more, the Janissaries were made up of the hardcore veterans of Murad II, as well as an infusion of new blood that was ready to prove itself in battle. And the core leadership was made up of the Hound Keepers. The only thing stopping Mehmed from turning the Ottoman military establishment right there and then into an unstoppable war machine that would make Genghis Khan get all giggly was, you guessed it, the old guard led by Kandarli. However, we will get more into the machinations of Kandarli in next week's episode. I'm hoping to conclude our 1451 through 1453 pre-siege period by then, and finally, we can bring down the great city together in a two-parter episode. Until then, thanks for tuning in, and I hope you'll join me next week. In the meantime, please give my website a visit and share this podcast with a friend. It really helps. Thank you.